KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, filmmaker Guillermo del Toro on the realities of dealing with the big studios.
I don't expect someone to greenlight a $150 million movie because I'm funny in a room or I'm a good dinner guest.
But first, on the Hollywood News Banter, Netflix makes a big splash in the Emmy nominations. The broadcast networks, not so much. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined in the studio by my guest co-banterer, Michael O'Connell. He covers television for The Hollywood Reporter, and he's here in John Horn's place this week because we're talking a lot about television. Hi, Mikey.
Hi, Kim.
So, Mikey, Emmy nominations came out on Thursday, and it was a real victory of sorts, I guess. How would you interpret the, what is it, dozen for Netflix? How many did they get?
They got 14 nominations.
14. So what do you think?
I think it's pretty much expected for House of Cards, not totally expected. It could have gone either way. But if they were going to go, they were going to go big. And people really reacted to the show. Way less love for Arrested Development, though. Years and years and years in the making and only 3 nominations. None for Best Comedy.
But all in all, I'd say Netflix, they campaigned aggressively in innovative ways.
They did, and it paid off. They put signs on people's front lawns. They passed out barbecue in front of office buildings. They were pretty much hard to avoid for the last month and a half.
Yeah, not so long ago, it was a huge deal that Basic Cable, Mad Men, got nominated. And actually, it's only Basic Cable drama ever to win Best Drama Series. But that was a huge deal just a few short years ago. And now we're beyond the medium of cable into people watching things on their laptop and binge viewing.
Oh, yeah.
Meanwhile, cable dominant in the nominations.
All the top nominees are cable shows. Starting with American Horror Story, Game of Thrones just behind it with 16, Behind the Candelabra with 15, Breaking Bad, and then in the middle there, tied for number 3 with 15 is Saturday Night Live, the most nominated broadcast show, just above 30 Rock, which, of course, is no longer on the air.
Yeah, well, that's pretty damning in a way for broadcast. I mean, it's emblematic of what has actually happened here, which is that broadcast is just being largely aced out in all of this. And, you know, they do operate under different constraints from cable. They have less freedom, and a lot of talent has migrated to cable.
Yes, and outside of comedy, they're leaving a very small footprint. Drama and mini and movie has gone completely the way of cable.
There's like one drama, which is sort of not a cable drama, I guess, that's nominated, and that's Downton Abbey,
Downton
right?
Abbey, the imported show that's neither really broadcast or cable, but still a lot of love for that this year after last year's big surge when they moved from the mini movie category to drama series.
You know, we should talk a little bit about this gaming of categories, because one of the reasons American Horror Story may have done so well is that it dodged the best drama, super competitive best drama category, which includes things like Mad Men and Breaking Bad and these strong cable contenders.
Which has got to be frustrating for a lot of other television series because it is a TV show. It's on every year. It runs for 10 or 12 episodes. I can't remember. But I think everyone's just so far out of the anthology series that sort of died out in the 90s that they can just stick it wherever they want to.
And they've decided it's a miniseries.
Yes, a maxi miniseries.
Maybe that's the new category of the, because a lot of networks are doing limited series now, cable
yes.
and broadcast. And
limited, event, mini, all very buzzy right now.
Right. Maybe we have to invent a special category for them. So, Mikey, just to wrap it up here, why don't you give me what you feel are some of the bigger snubs and surprises?
Eric Stonestreet, I would have to say.
Modern Family.
Yes, Modern Family's Eric Stonestreet won twice in supporting. That cast bands together every year and only submits themselves as supporting. And he's the only one not nominated this year, and he is the winningest of them all. Every other adult lead is in there for supporting.
Ooh, that's got to hurt.
I know.
What about Surprise? Has anybody really shocked you on that list?
I was really surprised to see Anthony Bourdain down for Best Host of a Reality Competition. The Taste on ABC did not make that much of an impact, even though it was renewed. And in that category, Bourdain takes the place of Jeff Probst, a longtime favorite.
Survivor. Yes, the Survivor failed to survive.
Yes, and also, like, an Emmy memory. He was a part of that five-way hosting debacle of reality hosts a couple of years ago when they had everyone in the category co-MC.
Speaking of reality programming, we'll just segue to a changing of the guard. There's a lot of sort of flux in the industry right now. We talked a few weeks ago on The Banter about Mike Darnell, the longtime head of reality at Fox, a guy who had pioneered, really, for better or for worse, you know, from American Idol to stuff like The Swan, the plastic surgery makeover show.
A reboot of which is still in the works at Fox without Darnell now.
Oh, dear. But Mike Darnell was ousted, really, at Fox. You know, he said he wanted to leave, but it was perceived maybe that American Idol had taken an incredibly sharp fall in the ratings, and X Factor was sort of sputtering along.
Yeah, he said he voted himself off.
He voted himself off Fox, and where did he vote himself onto?
Voted himself onto Warner Brothers, which is very interesting because Warner Brothers, of course, produces The Voice, the heir to American Idol's rating throne.
On NBC. So he will now oversee, he's going to be in a newly created position, president of unscripted and alternative programming, and they have more than just The Voice.
They do. They also produce The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, both standbys for ABC, and the lesser-watched Oh Sit on the CW, which, of course, is the extreme musical chairs show.
Oh, yeah. It's just right on my DVR. So I guess we feel that maybe Warner Brothers is going to be more aggressively in this space, and Mike Darnell is the guy to take them there. Thank you, Mikey.
Of course. Thank you, Kim.
That's Michael O'Connell. He covers television for The Hollywood Reporter, sitting in for John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Coming up next, filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. Pacific Rim is an apocalypse movie in which humanity uses massive robots to battle gigantic monsters while trying to figure out what makes those monsters tick.
I need to access a kaiju brain. Completely intact.
No. The skull plate is so dense that by the time you drill into it...
The brain's rotted away, but I'm talking about the secondary brain. Now, we both know that the kaiju are so large they need two brains to move around like a dinosaur. I want to get my hands on that.
Pacific Rim has its fans, but it was a big bet that is likely to lose $50 million or more for its backers, Legendary Entertainment and Warner Brothers. We talked with director Guillermo del Toro as the film was opening, and even then it was clear from box office tracking that it would probably fail to do the kind of business needed to be profitable. Disappointing, yes, but del Toro has a passionate following for his fearless originality. His work has been eclectic, from the comic horror Hellboy movies to the Spanish-language arthouse fantasy Pan's Labyrinth. That movie was nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film in 2007. He was executive producer on DreamWorks Animation's Puss in Boots, Kung Fu Panda 2, and Rise of the Guardians. But until he made Pacific Rim, del Toro hadn't directed a movie since Hellboy 2 in 2008. Not that he didn't try. In fact, he suffered a number of disappointments in recent years. He spent 2 years preparing to direct The Hobbit, but left the project when it seemed indefinitely stalled. He spent a year preparing the adventure horror film At the Mountains of Madness, but Universal pulled the plug. Meanwhile, Rise of the Guardians fared poorly at the box office, leading DreamWorks Animation to take a loss of $87 million. Pacific Rim is the biggest, most expensive movie del Toro has ever directed. It reportedly cost $190 million. I asked del Toro how he was reacting to research showing that the film might fall short financially.
Marketing, polling, all this stuff is not my expertise, not my field of expertise. So I'm nervous about that to a point, but I've seen the movie now about eight
times.
With an audience,
mm-hmm.
and I'm happy. So, you know, yes, I'm watchful, but I am not. I go through seas of calm and acute episodes of anxiety, you know, but I'm not constantly anxious about it.
Because there's been so much. I mean, you're coming right off the heels of The Lone Ranger, mm-hmm. spectacular yeah. bomb. And the movies have become, I don't know, did you feel that you needed to make this large movie to be in the Hollywood game of today? Or did you just want to make it this movie?
Oh, without a doubt, I just wanted to make this movie. You know, I have all my life, all my career has been driven by purely idiosyncratic emotions. I only do things I completely believe in. I say no to things I don't. Big, gigantic things. Coming out of The Hobbit, I was offered one of the biggest movies of the last 3 years. And I said, I'm not the guy to do it. I don't understand the mythology behind it. And I said, no.
You're not going to tell us what that
no,
is?
No, I'm not. Okay. I mean, it's that is etiquette. You know, but I really will say this. The only chance I have of having peace as a storyteller is tell the stories I do care about. And I don't care if the budget is gigantic or small. I'm happy. The next project I'm doing right now is a pilot for FX, for The Strain, the series based
right,
on my
book. Right, the television
book.
Show.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I have 20 days to shoot it. You know, so Pacific Rim was 103 days. So I'm comfortable going from one size or one schedule to another very, very much.
You hadn't directed a film for some years, though.
Yeah.
It's been since you said Hellboy 2.
5 years, yeah.
5 years.
Yeah.
So did you feel like, well, I need to get back and direct a film? Or, but, I mean, obviously some of that time was consumed, I guess, with Hobbit.
Hobbit was 2 years, and then 1 year was consumed with parallel preparation of Mountains of Madness and Pacific Rim at the same time. There was always the understanding that if Mountains didn't happen or if the schedule cleared, I would do Pacific Rim. And that's 3 years right there. And then the 3 years of Pacific Rim, one of which overlaps, that's the 5 years. It's difficult to embark in a project of a big size and then it not happening. It takes a chunk away.
Yeah, you've been through quite a lot of that in the last few years.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go into the whole saga of The Hobbit,
mm-hmm.
but I am curious about the effect of it. When you invested so deeply, I just was reading the New Yorker article where they talked about your designs and it wasn't like you had just flirted with The Hobbit. You were in New Zealand.
I moved my whole family. I bought 2 homes. We stayed there full 2 years. What it is I had the best time of my life living in Wellington.
It's great there.
It's an amazing town, one of the most beautiful countries in the world, great people. And it was just time to make a decision. I put a couple of thresholds and I said, if we cross them and everything is not resolved and I can get a green light, I'll leave. And I don't look back. I don't look back and say, oh, it got greenlit, it got made. I don't look back. I'm blessed with a very, very disproportionately small rearview mirror.
A small rearview mirror.
Yeah.
But creatively, did you feel like, I mean, I don't know, I'm hardly going to analogize writing a story to making a film, but, mm-hmm. you know, if I write a difficult story,
yes.
I'm kind of depleted for a while, and I feel like I pay. I have to sit there.
I don't sit there. I am incapable of sitting there. I mean, I just finished Pacific Rim. It was a gigantic adventure. It was a huge endeavor. I'm taking 7 days off and into the pre-production of The Strain. I'm already in pre-production.
Seven
of the
days
Strain.
Off.
That's all I can manage. I love working. I am socially inept, and I am a very strange
creature. You
seem
very nice right now.
Well, no, yeah, but I'm not. I'm not a guy. I fit in what I do. Making movies is my life, and my family travels with me. We are a circus family. They married a strange circus performer. They travel with me. We live that life, and that's it. Actually, fits in the cinema.
Pragmatically speaking, how many are in that party, and what about your kids are in school, right?
Yeah, my daughters are 12 and 17. So the 17-year-old is on the verge of saying, I'm not traveling anymore, which is perfectly legitimate, and we'll find a solution. And I actually tried to solve it to their favor, to go to cities they want to live in and trying to accommodate them living near a park or whatever they want. I tried to do it. But it is a nomadic life.
And the kid moves from school to school. You take a tutor with you?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I mean, I went to Europe the first time in my 20s. And my daughters have lived in Prague, Budapest, UK, Madrid. The older one speaks 3 or 4 languages. So, you know, every family has idiosyncrasies. I think family is by nature imperfect. You know, it's an imperfect little society. But if there's love, everything's good.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. As he was preparing to make his new film, Pacific Rim, he was also hoping to launch another project based on the H.P. Lovecraft horror novella At the Mountains of Madness. Despite having Tom Cruise attached to star and James Cameron producing, Universal pulled the plug before production got underway. The issue was del Toro's insistence on an R rating. With a budget of $150 million, that choice would limit the film's potential box office performance.
I do understand the reasons. So from a business point of view, I actually understand and I can see that point of view. It still was difficult for me. But, you know, although I do not follow the inside baseball sport of the business, I do know that business decisions are business decisions. And I don't expect someone to greenlight a $150 million movie because I'm funny in a room or I'm a good dinner guest.
Right.
You know, I understand all that. But, you know, I think that if I could go back in time, I would find a solution. I would try to, but it didn't happen.
What would that be?
I think that the idea of a dual cut is a good idea. The idea of releasing
a PG-13 version.
PG-13 on one format, like IMAX, let's say, or the opposite, R for IMAX and PG, like a couple of weeks apart or a few weeks apart, something like that. But, you know, it's a speculation.
So do we think that Mountains of Madness comes back, or we don't know yet?
You know, I know I'm going to sound glib, but that's above my pay rate. Those decisions do not rest in the hands of filmmakers. It's the dichotomy and the paradox of this business that is show business. I'm in the show part of the term, and I do my best on that part. But the other part, I find that the more you play it, the more dangerous it gets for you as a storyteller. It sort of taints the water a little bit. Like, I very comfortably right now, if I had the screenplay to do it, I would go back and do a $10 million movie like Pants or Devil's Backbone easily. I've done it in the past.
I think you might almost prefer it because the anxiety diminishes.
Well, it's different anxiety. Actually, yeah. Pan's Labyrinth was hugely one of the worst anxiety movies I've ever shot. I was in hell because we had no budget. We had some people that didn't want the movie to happen at the time. It was very difficult to finance it when you pitch it. Now it sounds brilliant, right? But when you were pitching it, I'm doing a fairy tale in the time of fascist Spain. And the girl, spoiler,
yeah,
the girl dies at the
end. Happens, yeah.
Yeah. So it was really, trust me, I saw everyone and nobody wanted to finance it.
You know, you have this very fecund imagination and you seem to say that you can take that anxiety and just kind of will it away.
To a point. Again, I go steady, and then huge acute episode of anxiety. And I do... I'm a warrior.
Yeah.
Well, the technique is just, can you do something about it? And if you can, I worry, and then I find what I need to do about it, and I deal with it really quick. But if I cannot do anything about it, I got to find peace. Now, some nights, I get very little sleep. When I'm shooting, I'm waking up, I'm sleeping 3 hours.
Oof.
When I'm shooting, you know. But... you know, the older you get, I find that you manage it differently. I was much more anxious when I was young. At the end of the day, there's an assurance that comes from knowing yourself that only happens with age.
After a short break, Guillermo del Toro talks about where he sees the business heading. To hear outtakes from this interview, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. His latest movie, Pacific Rim, is currently in theaters. Del Toro has plenty of other projects in the pipeline to absorb his attention. He's executive producing Kung Fu Panda 3 for DreamWorks Animation, and he's getting into TV with the adaptation of The Strain for FX. That's based on his own vampire novels of that name. Del Toro is also co-owner of the digital company Mirada, which produces commercials, films, and all kinds of digital content. And it's in the convergence of all this that Del Toro sees the future of the business.
What I know I can tell you as a storyteller, I think that we are coming to a very interesting fusion of the storytelling, and the business is going to accommodate that. The relationship people have with media is at the same time more intimate and more ephemeris, you know? But we are now being guided to a different route by the what I call is the mono console, a little device that is a reality already in several platforms where you're going to have at home the possibility to download a movie, to browse the internet, to tape your cable and play games. All of that in one console for us is cutting edge. For the next generation growing up is normalcy. And that's where the change is going to occur. And I assure you, I don't think none of us knows where it's going to go.
Right.
But it's gonna be that mono console that is gonna change storytelling, and we have to be mindful of all that media, and that's why in the last 3-4 years I started an apprenticeship for myself to go into TV, to go into writing novels, to go into designing video games, because as a storyteller I just say I better know not only as a user. I want to know this, constructing it. I started 4 years ago at DreamWorks to completely immerse myself in animation, because I think that's part of the change also. So I'm curious, but I don't speculate much in terms of the business.
Let me just touch on DreamWorks, because that is another setback. That was Rise of the Guardians. That mm-hmm. was a tough loss mm-hmm. for DreamWorks Animation. Mm-hmm. Was there a lesson from that?
I think that we have a movie that was, I think it was, if not the highest, one of the highest scoring movies in the testing at DreamWorks. We were all coming from that information. I think that the message of the movie and it connecting with the audience is what was missing. Now, ironically, the movie has become huge on the home video
right.
market. You know, now it's huge on DVD, huge on downloads, and it found its audience. And the only consolation I can have that is not just ephemeral is the movies find their audience.
I mean, there's been some discussion in the past that, you know, you have all sorts of projects that you're doing simultaneously, and mm-hmm. I have to admit, reading, I got dizzy trying to sort them out.
Well, sadly, the story of that list of projects is more projects that have been developed to a point and have not fructified, you
right.
know? I have written or co-written approximately 23 screenplays. I've done only 8 movies, so that gives you the rate. And anyone that has ever written a screenplay know what that entitles.
Right.
The effort, the sweat, the long months.
So even Guillermo del Toro has that kind of batting average.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
No.
Mm-hmm.
People look at a career from the outside and think there is some plan. When you experience a career, it's literally like a very, very slow motion car crash. And you are now going towards the steering wheel. You're now breaking your teeth. You're bouncing back. You don't break your neck because you hit the headrest. And that's one movie and that's another one. And you're experiencing them inside the car tumbling. And from the outside, you have commentators that comment on that.
Look, that he just
look! Oh my God, he just broke his teeth again. Couldn't he have moved to the left? What was he thinking?
Right.
You know,
I'm feeling guilty right now.
No,
but go ahead.
No, it is that, and I think that you can learn so much more from failure than from success. And I think experience, and as you grow older, you realize that. So you. I'm not saying you welcome failure, but you do welcome adversity to a point, you know, and you know that success always is very easy to learn the wrong lesson from success. Super easy. And no one in our culture prepares you for that. Everybody tells you how to deal with failure. Nobody says you need management to deal with success properly because it's seen as a cure-all. Or the end-all of end-all.
Can you give us an example of a lesson you learned from success that was bad or a lesson from failure that was really good?
You know, I can tell you that I never made Pan's Labyrinth to be nominated for Academy Awards. That happened, but I didn't do it for that. But if at the beginning of my life, when I did Kronos, first movie, it won the Grand Prix of the Critics Week at Cannes.
Yeah.
If I had at that point said, oh, I'm going to make my movies to continue winning awards, they probably would have eluded me, or they probably would have never happened or happened the wrong way. I'll give you another example. There's a movie called Mimic, which was incredibly difficult for me to do. And I learned a fantastic word from that failure and that pain, a word that is vital, but I didn't know as a Mexican filmmaker, and the word is no. You know? And if it feels wrong, it's wrong. And you say no. You know? And I
no
learned
to the
it.
Project?
Not to the project or not to the idea. It doesn't matter if it's the head of the studio, an executive, a producer. If it feels that you should say no, you say no. And that was a big lesson. And the movie is not by any means a success, but I learned a lot. I think that there's a thing that is very easy to say when you haven't been tried. When somebody tells me, I don't sell out, you say, have someone ever tried to be bought, you know? When you have, and you have your own personal episode where you know you have a boundary, that's really good. And that often happens if you learn the right lesson from success, or if you learn the right lesson from failure, either.
We have read that you have experienced lucid dreaming, what you call lucid dreaming, since you were a child. And is that something, how does that work? And does it's part of the filmmaking and the creation?
Well, it stopped when I was a kid.
It stopped.
It happens now and then. It happened to me once in my 20s, and it was terrifying. What happens is you fall asleep, and you wake up in the dream in the room you're in.
I have had that happen. Yeah. I did not know.
You're still asleep. You're in a dream, but you don't think you're in a dream.
Right.
And things happen, and you experience things that look real. And when I was a kid, I used to see monsters. I used to see a fawn coming from behind the armoire in front of my bed. I used to see things in the my parents had this 1960s shaggy carpet that was green. Imagine that, very 60s.
Yeah.
And I used to see the shaggy strands move like fingers.
Oh.
And I knew that if I stepped on them, they would grab me and sink me, pull me down somewhere. And then I would wake up. And the last time I had that lucid dream was when I had just married my wife, like about 6 months into the marriage. I dreamt I was in bed and there was a fire, and I sensed the fire through my closed eyes, and I woke up and I saw a burning man sitting down in the sofa across from me, and the guy got up and walked towards me with his arms extended and said, "I live." And I woke up screaming. You know, but it's fortunately not something I experience anymore. But it is a very powerful experience.
Does it feed into the monster creation?
No, you know, my dreams are daydreams. Mm. I have an incredibly active imagination. That's for good, for the creation. But if my wife is an hour late, I imagine all kinds of paranoid scenarios. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so it's not good for daily life, but it's great at inventing stories.
Guillermo del Toro is a filmmaker. His latest movie is Pacific Rim. It's in theaters now. Thank you so much for coming in.
A pleasure.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.